You know, Vol Yom Tov, I think Pesach needs more preparation than any of them, almost all of them combined. Yeah. I mean, every holiday needs a spiritual preparation. You know, for Shavuos, you inspire yourself and commit yourself to learning Torah. And certainly Sukkot requires a lot of preparation, but Pesach, it's like unbelievable. I mean, because you have an Isur Chametz, how are you? You have an Isur of Bal Yiroh Bal Yimotzeh, which means not only do you have to get rid of your chametz, you're not allowed to even have chametz anywhere in your possession, anywhere in your property. Besides that, you've got to prepare for the Seder. I mean, there's just so much that has to be prepared just to put together the shulchan, and it's just endless. So that's why I think when Chazal say that you should start learning the laws of Pesach 30 days before the Chag, they meant business. Because there's just so much to learn. We've been learning Arvei Pesachim a little bit here on Wednesday nights, and it just goes on and on. Just on the Seder itself, you could probably spend hours and hours of preparation, the Manishtana, and just to understand the Haggadah, the Magid, the relationship to the parasha of Ki Tovo of Arami Ovid Ovi, which, you know, the whole backbone of the Haggadah is about Arami Ovid Ovi, and what, you know, why was that parasha chosen for the mitzvah of Haggadah? There's no explicit source for that. And then to try to figure out how the Seder works, how the Karo works, all this is just enormous. You know, people who learn the laws of Kashrus for the whole year round, you know, you're a day chelik aleph, and they get tested for smicha. So much of that is rooted in Pesachim, in the laws of Pesach. Because if chametz gets mixed in, what do you do? Or if you have a pot where you cooked chametz and now you want to use the pot on Pesach, how do you prepare it? So all this and much more is it's all included in Shloshim Yom Kodem Lachag. And you really have to prepare yourself, you have to learn. So what I would like to accomplish tonight is to try to at least, maybe this will be a two-part series, at least in this first part, to talk a little about how to prepare the kitchen for Pesach. Kashering Kalim a little bit. Maybe we could talk about some of the principles. And maybe we'll get a chance to talk about medicines, cosmetics. Perhaps we can discuss kidneys, which is a very important issue. And also, if you have any questions that you want to raise, you know, some practical issues, you can ask. I'm not sure I'll have all the answers, but at least we can discuss them. So let's start with the basics of kashering. Is it time to start? I mean, what? It's
1 minute, yeah.
Oh, we have to wait one more minute? Okay, so...
I have 3 minutes, yeah. It says 7:27 right now.
You have 27? What time does it say on that clock?
The next says 7:28 and a half.
Okay, so whenever we get a chance, yeah. we'll start and...
Can I tell my comments now?
Are you leaving to Chutz Arts? Are you?
No.
So
you have to get a hold of.
Right. No, I'll be here pretty much every day for starting from Sunday. But I'll give you my phone number if you want to call me, just in case you want to know for sure that I'm here. Do you want to jot that down?
I think I have it.
You have it? Okay. Because I usually start selling chametz around Rosh Chodesh. Yeah, 2 weeks before Pesach. So honestly, I don't have yet the preparation, but... Okay.
46 years ago, when I was at Hartman, the yeshiva with Chaim Bravender, we learned Arvei Pesachim. So, and then subsequent to that,
So you're up on the issues then?
Well, not up on it. I mean,
you could probably take an exam. And
no question.
Well, one of the things I try to do in selling chametz is to encourage people to try to use up most of the chametz that they have, and to rely on the mechira for things that are absolutely necessary, you know, that you can't finish up. But you have little things here that you started and it's a piece of bread or cookies or something and you haven't finished it, just get rid of it. Toss it out. Don't bother selling it. And also, we don't sell kelim. We don't sell utensils. Because I'll tell you the truth, if we sell utensils, and this is a whole other topic, maybe we'll get into it tonight, then we need tefillas kelim. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, because then it went into the Rishus of the Goy.
Oh, wait a minute. So our non-Pesedic Kalim,
right.
we keep them in storage.
Correct, but we don't sell them.
Yeah, we don't sell them. Okay.
That's what I'm saying. So it's not included in the in the contract.
To get rid of them.
I didn't mean to say that. In fact, what we want to discuss is the possibility of even using them on Pesach if you subject them to kasher.
Yeah, right. If it's all metal and all that stuff.
Things like that. We'll talk about metals, porcelain.
Oh, porcelain.
Yeah, earthenware. We'll talk about glass. You know, the many different kinds of utensils and made of different things. That's why I call this shiur contemporary, because in contemporary, back in the old days, it was mostly pottery, but today we have so many different kinds of utensils.
Right.
But included in the mechira is any chametz that you might own in your possession. Right. I ask people if they know that this chametz is in a certain place to specify.
Specify the location.
You know, tell me where it is. And if they're going away and they won't be accessible, you know, we can't get to them, then to leave a key with somebody and write in the shtar, I'll do it for you, where exactly the key can be found. Because otherwise, if the non-Jew who's buying your chametz has no way of accessing your chametz, he doesn't know where it is, it's not really a valid mechira. Yeah, it's just a kind of a facade, if you know what I mean. And mechira's chametz is important.
Yeah, it should be a valid.
I also announced on Shabbos here that if anybody needs my help to give out Maos Chitim, my father's grandfather, that was my father's mother's father, was very makpid. He was a big, you know, so he used to say about Maos Chitim, you hear this? Either you. I'll give you an envelope, because otherwise. I don't want to lose it. Yeah, that's the thing. Okay, I'll try to. So he used to say, either you give Maos Chitin or you receive Maos Chitin. One of the two. There's no middle ground. Yeah. That was what he used to say. In Yiddish, it comes out very sharp. Or the Megift or the Menemt. You know, those are your two choices. All right, I think it's time to begin our discussion about Kasher and Kalim. And as I said before, if you have any questions as we go along, please feel free to ask them. The first principle, and the most important principle in Kasher and Kalim, is called Kibolo Kachpolto, which means to the same way they went in and they were absorbed in the kli, that's how you have to get them out. And that fits into many different categories. For example, you can cook something on an open fire, and that's called bishul al gabi ha'esh. And then, in order to kasher it and get the bliya out that went in through cooking on top of a fire, you have to fill up the utensil with water. And while it's under the fire, you have to make sure that the water covers the entire kli. Now, let's say, for example, I only have one kli, and I have to do hag'olah, which means boiling hot water on that kli. How do I make sure that the outside of this big utensil is also covered by the water?
Wow.
From the lip and down, on the outside. So for that, we have something called an even milubenis, which means that we heat up a stone, and we throw it into the pot. Once that happens, because the pot is full, then it flows over, and now the outside of the pot is also subject to hagolah.
Well,
everything is perfect.
Stations that you see, you know, these teenagers, you know, have these major pots filled with boiling hot water. You know, they just stick the pot right in there completely, so it's
correct.
A complete immersion.
So that's great, but if in your own house, it's hard to get such a gigantic vat. And the question is, you want to take your largest utensil and designate that for the Haga'olah, but the largest utensil itself has to be Pesedik. And if it's not Pesedik, you have to do Haga'olah on that.
Yeah.
So here you have this large vat, and you know, the water is boiling. You see bubbles going up. That's called Ababuos. And then you know it's ready for Haga'olah.
Yeah.
But as far as that very first kli, or if you only have one kli, and it's a very large kli, then you have to throw something inside the kli to make sure that it spills over.
Right.
Now, it's very interesting, because under the lip of the utensil, there's a lot of grease, a lot of oil, you know, that has been absorbed over the course of time, especially if you use this pot for cooking large numbers of people, you know, audiences. So some want to be very careful, and they want to use a blowtorch on the outside lip of the utensil. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
To get that hummus stick of grease off.
That grease off. And if you've never seen it, it's really something to see, because you could be standing there with the blowtorch for I don't know how many minutes, and nothing really is happening. And then all of a sudden, snap your finger, you don't know when it's going to happen, the whole thing goes up in smoke, and all the grease just comes rolling down. It's an amazing sight to see. That's one way of understanding Kibbolah Kachpolto. Of course, I cooked on it.
I don't know what that's all about. I'm gonna just turn it right off.
Okay, I cooked on an open fire. That's. But let's say, for example, I may have utensils which were never on an open fire, and that would be in the worst case scenario what's called kli rishon. Kli rishon means that I took the contents of the pot that was on the fire and I poured it into a second utensil. That's already called, when you pour it, it's called the Iri Kli Rishon, and then in the second utensil, it's called Kli Shein. That's called the Kli Shein. So certain things that never really get cooked in a Kli Rishon, they're never used in that context, so then all you need is a Kli Shein. Okay, that's called Hagolah. And that's pretty basic. Obviously, before Hagolah, what you want to do is you want to make sure that there's no actual Be'en, what we call bet ayin yud, no actual morsels or pieces of chametz. If there are and you can't get them out, you can't for some reason, as much as you use the steel wool and you can't clean them out, those should be subject to what's called libun, which is what I said before, when you use a blowtorch, and you can do the blowtorch just for those areas, and then the rest of the kli you do hagol.
What about a steam machine? You know,
would probably not get it hot enough.
I see.
Because what we need is what's called Yad Soledes Bo. It's got to be really boiling hot. Now we have a different thing. What about something that has chametz and it's used, a utensil that's used directly on the fire without any liquid substance in between? It's not like you're cooking it with boiling water, but you use it directly with hot chametz, like for example an oven. When you cook in an oven, what you're really doing is either baking or broiling or whatever it is, then you have a different halach of kibolo kapolto. Now hagol is not going to be sufficient. You're going to need what's called libun. And libun fits into two categories. There's something called libun kal, an easy kind of libun, a libun, and then there's the libun chamur, which is more, the real libun, which is libun chamur, requires that the whole thing changes its color. That's how red it gets from the heat. Takes a long time to get to that. In general, we try to avoid libun chamur. We ask for the person to just buy himself a new set of dishes if it needs libun chamur. But if it needs libun kal, That's relatively easy. It's not totally easy, but then you don't have to turn the color of the metal and make it into red hot. But you have to make it hot enough so if you took a straw and you placed the straw against the kli, it would scorch that straw. That's called libun kal.
Yeah, we just have, you know, Pesedic cooking dishes, you know, milchik, fleishik, and that.
Correct, but in my day, when I was brought up in my house, we actually kashered the kitchen.
Well,
we didn't have, you know, today there's so many ways of buying disposables and so on.
Well, that's different. That's
you know what I mean? It's almost unnecessary, but nevertheless, we have to know the principles. We have to know the laws. So let me just summarize what we've seen so far. Number one, kibolo kachpolto, the way it was absorbed, that's the way you have to get it out. So if it was absorbed with hot water, like a pot that you cook with, then you have to place it into hot water over the fire. Again, the fire is alive and well, and that's called hagola. Let me add that in hagola, not only do you have to clean the pot to make sure there's no chametz on it, but we also have a minute of waiting 24 hours. Don't use it for 24 hours. And the reason for that is because of a principle called No Saint Tam Livgam. Are you familiar with that principle? then it means after 24 hours, the tam that's polua inside the kli is pogum. It's not, it doesn't really give you a good taste. So that itself is enough to lower it down one notch from a doraisa to a drabanon. And then after that we do hagol. Next principle, limun. Limun means that it has direct contact with the fire without any liquids. For example, we can talk about what's called a shiput. The shiput is, in English, it's called a spit. Are you familiar with it? It's like a long piece, and you use it for like shish kebab or something like that. Shibudim, and it goes over the fire directly without any liquid. That needs limun. That needs to be put, you know, you have to get hot.
Burn
it out. That's called limun. Or, for example, tavnit afia, you have baking pans. All this needs libun. And when I say libun, I mean the real thing in libun. Yeah, you have to make sure the walls of the utensil are red hot. Okay. Next. We pointed out that before you do hagolah, not only do you wait 24 hours, but you have to get rid of any of the, you know, the solid pieces on the kli. And if you can't get rid of those solid pieces by cleaning them off, then you blowtorch those. However, the poskim say that in a fallback position, if you can't get rid of those pieces of morsels of solid foods that are connected to the kli, you could use in Hebrew it's called a chomer nikud. That means, let me see, I think I have it in English here somewhere, because my translation in English is a little bit lacking here. Chomer nikui, is acidic cleaning material.
Nikui, okay.
Right, acidic cleaning material. This is the kind of stuff like Economica that you buy, or those very, very heavy chemical substances that...
Well, years ago, before you had the self-cleaning oven, you would use that to clean your oven.
Right, yeah. Right. I think they called it Easy Off, if you remember that. Very dangerous, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Don't get that on your hands.
Oh,
you gotta wear gloves. These are acidic materials that could be very, very dangerous. And once you put those materials on top of the food, it becomes what's called nifsal me'achilas kelev. It's not even fit for a dog to eat. That's how bad it is. So that would cover that. Okay, fine. Now, there are such things in contemporary life as utensils, which if you kasher them, they might get damaged. And such utensils cannot be kashered. We'll give examples later, but that's just the principle.
Mm-hmm.
Next, lechatchila, what we try to do is make sure that every agola has fire underneath it. Even though, as I said before, there are certain cases of certain kalim where maybe you don't need the fire, technically. It could be a kli rishon, or iri kli rishon, or in the original pot, but without the fire on it. But because of chametz, which is very... Now, very severe Easter, and we want to be very careful, it's chomer. Therefore, we always want to have the ash going under the fire, under the pot. Okay. Now, after we place the pot and we dunk it into the hot boiling water with the bubbles going up, and that's called hagola, we take out the pot and we rinse it off in cold water. That's called shtifa bitzoninim. That's rinsing it off in cold water. And this is a very important part of the process. It's not indispensable in the sense that the kashering was done already, but still is a separate mitzvah of shtifa to rinse it off with cold water. It's based on the parasha in Bamidbar Perek Vav, of Umarak Veshutaf Bamayim, which were applied to Clay Midjan when they took the booty from the, after the battle against Midjan, and there the Torah says you have to rinse it off afterwards.
So when I take, what we generally do is we go to the corner where these guys are,
right,
you know, this major pot, and we have our stuff dunked in it. I don't recall that they actually rinse it off in cold
water.
Yeah,
they have a hose usually. Oh, if, so they're, they, if they're doing it the right way, they have a hose with cold water. Otherwise, they're not doing it the right way. Right. Okay. Fine, we spoke about Libun. Chomor, we spoke about Libun. Kal, and the difference between the two. Now, there's one other category of Hechsher Kelim, which in my house, at least as a child growing up, was very, every year we did this, and that's called Shriya. Are you familiar with this?
Not that term.
Okay, what is Shriya? Shin Reish Yud Hei. Shriya means that if you have glassware that's used, let's say, for wine or any other sort of cold liquids, and they're never used with hot or with harif, they're never used for pickling or anything like that, then you want to use those glass kalim. What you do is shriya. Shriya means you fill up a bathtub and you put these glassware in the bathtub, and every 24 hours you let the water out and put in new water. And you do this for 3 days consecutively. So it's 72 hours. And again, this is something that in my house was every year my father did this. Yeah, this was, that was shriya.
For wine glasses, essentially.
Wine glasses would be an excellent, or what do you call those crystal wine canisters or whatever they're called. Yeah, right. You know, there's a word for it, but okay.
Yeah.
So that's what we have. That's what we have so far.
Carafe?
No, is that what it's called?
I don't know.
Okay. Now I want to talk to you about what in the kitchen cannot be kosher. Okay, number one, china, pottery, earthenware, anything, enamel, anything that makes from the earth itself cannot be kosher for Pesach. And the reason for that is that kli cheres eino yotze midei daf yol yol means that they're so porous that whatever gets absorbed, no matter what you do, you'll never get it out. The only possibility with those kalim, but again, I've never seen this, you know, maybe if you go to Venice or something in Italy, you'll see it, you can actually burn it down and restructure the whole kli, you know, but that's not practical. Okay. Now,
but fine china, I understand that you can, if you haven't used it for a year or something, that there's something about it that's perceived as different than Klicheris or something.
Well, it could be that you're talking about glazed china.
Well, I'm just using the term china.
Right, because I think the chinaware that we use today is glazed. It's not pure pottery.
Right.
Therefore it has a glass surface.
Yes.
And the truth is it's not really chinaware. What it really is, they pour the molten china or pottery together with glass into the fire.
Oh.
And it changes the whole substance of the kli. So that I think is different. But you'd have to really ask a question, Lamaisa, whether or not you can kasha that for Pesach. Plastic. Like, for example, a lot of ladies who are raising babies, they have bottles, you know, plastic bottles.
Yeah.
And the question is, can you kash that for Pesach? This became a whole issue. The Sfaradim, following Rav Ovadia Yosef, allow it. And the Ashkenazim, generally speaking, fit into one of two categories. Either they're not excited about kashering plastic, because plastic gets out of shape if you put it in boiling hot water, or if it's very hard plastic, they allow you. For example, in the army, tons of utensils that they eat with, you know, the bowls and the plates and so forth, they're all made of plastic, but very hard plastic.
Yeah.
So they allow kashering for Pesach. Could you imagine if the army, for thousands, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, would have to kasher, you know, they would have to replace all of the utensils that they use on an annual basis. I mean, nobody could imagine who could underwrite such a thing. So that was already the head to back of the chief rabbi of the army. His name was Rav Shlomo Garin, if you ever heard of him.
So he
already allowed it, and he said we can kasher it. I used to do this on an annual basis for 13 years in the army, and we never had a problem with the utensils. I never saw it break or bend out of shape. The plastic that we have is very
put it into boiling water,
water, masses of kalim, and that's how.
So
we,
for those who would hold that you can't kosher plastic like a baby bottle, you know, for the milk or something. that would be meaning that you need to buy new plastic things.
Correct. For and that's what I would probably recommend, you know, that if it's not too much of an expense,
you have Pacific rules, that's all.
Right, to buy new plastic bottles and change them for Pesach, but you could do a Hagola on it. It's quite possible to do a Hagola, and the Sfaradim for sure would be okay. Okay.
So I'll be Sephardic for Pesach.
No? Yeah, if you need to, right? If you can't buy replacement plastic, Caleb. Okay. Okay, let's talk about ovens. Okay, ovens have to be kashered for Pesach. Unless you can buy yourself a second oven and designate it for Pesach use on an annual basis. So the question is, how do you kasher an oven? Now, we're going to talk about two categories of ovens. There's what's called the self-cleaning oven, and that's a cinch.
Yes.
And then there's the non-self-cleaning oven. Now, that's more complicated. As far as the self-cleaning oven is concerned, everybody agrees that you just have to clean everything out, make sure it's absolutely clean. And after that, you turn on the cycle. It's usually about a 30-minute cycle, self-cleaning on the highest flame, and you're okay. The post can even allow you in such a case to leave the trays inside the self-cleaning oven while this process is going on, the racks, because that's called libun. Oh. And that's a very strict libun. I mean, it's a high level of libun chamur, even though it won't turn red, but it doesn't matter because the self-cleaning oven has a certain mechanical system in it which prevents it from turning red, but it's an absolute libun. But many have the custom of covering the grates in any event, even, you know, with silver foil, even though it's technically kosher, and the super duper religious people will buy new racks, you know, new grates for the oven.
You know what we do, or what I've done in the past, as I recall, is we take out those grates and we take them to that big measure pot, you know, that's the boiling thing, because it's all metal.
Right. The reason why I'm not excited about that is because I'm worried about the fact that it might need libun, and Hagol is not enough if you have, let's say, kugel, you know, that's sitting on these grates
cooked into it, yeah,
and there's no liquid substance, that's really libun, that's really fire without a medium of water, of liquid, so it might need libun. But again, I would say the following: we could rely on the following coolest. We could, number one, use the self-cleaning oven, take out the racks before you turn it on, take the racks to do Hagolah on it, and I think it's okay.
Oh.
But I think even in such a case, I would encourage covering the racks, if possible, with silver foil. That would be my recommendation. Now, if it's a non-self-cleaning oven, then there are those who are not excited about kashering them, and would certainly discourage you from doing so. But Lamaisa, there are two different ways of kashering them. One would be, again, after cleaning them out very thoroughly, to turn on the oven to the temperature which is 500 degrees Fahrenheit, or 550 degrees Fahrenheit, and leave it on for a full hour in this case. And again, all this is assuming you haven't used the oven in 24 hours. In both cases, whether it's a self-cleaning oven or a non-self-cleaning oven, make sure that for 24 hours you didn't use the oven. Again, if b'di'evet you went ahead and you did the kashering without waiting the 24 hours, but you were absolutely guaranteed that it was clean, then b'di'evet, I'd say certainly the kashering process is fine. Now I want to talk to you a little bit about stovetops, right?
Yeah,
Not the oven inside, but on top.
Right.
And here we really divide up into three issues. Number one is the, I don't know what you call them, the grates themselves, you know, on which the pot sits, you know, those iron things. Number two is the burners, which are those metal things where the fire is attached to. And number three is the countertop itself that separates, let's say, one burner from the other.
Yeah, we have a Pesach stovetop that we change.
So that's great.
We just take it off.
That's one. But if you don't have, we don't have one. So what we do is, first, in order to kasher the stovetop, and I'm not talking about a glass stovetop, that's a little bit different. What we do is we cover the metal itself with heavy-duty silver foil. Then we turn on the flame.
Oh, heavy-duty.
Right?
Because otherwise it'll, yeah.
And then we wait until it's just about ready to go up in smoke. The silver foil itself is red. And that's when we know it's done. As far as the burners are concerned, all you need is to turn on the flame for about 15 minutes, and that's fine. The burners on top, you know, the grates on top, whatever you call them, that's going to take a little bit of time till it really does a leibud job. And then what we try to do is cover the porcelain, which separates the different parts, you know, of the stovetop, with silver foil. That doesn't require heavy-duty silver foil. But
after you've done the leibud.
Yeah, so I did three things now. Yeah. I did the real McCoy leibud on the grates themselves.
So you have like a blowtorch or something, I guess. Huh?
No, not a blowtorch. I'm turning on the fire.
You're turning on the fire.
And when you turn on the fire, you'll see that after, I don't know how long it takes, I'd have to ask my wife to remember from year to year, but it takes a while, but ultimately the silver foil starts burning. It really gets red hot.
You're putting silver foil on the grates.
Correct.
As you are heating.
Like, watch my fingers for a second, right? These are the tongs that sort of meet, and then they hold up the pot.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about, that part. Well, I'm just trying to see how he calls that.
Why not just burn?
Metal grates, he called it.
Yeah, but why not just turn the fire on without the aluminum foil on it?
The aluminum foil will give me an idea when it reaches the state of leibud.
It really turns
kind of reddish. You know, you see the outside of it starts going up in smoke. It gets red and black. And
so you're not wrapping the grates with it. You're just, or you are?
Yeah, I actually wrap the grates. Our meaning. You don't have to do that. I'm just telling you why we do it.
Yeah.
Well, and then you have the burners themselves. That's about a 15 minute.
I don't have to change the stovetop if we do it yourself.
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm not recommending changing the stovetop just to make life easier for if you want to avoid this.
I like to
cover the porcelain on the top. Okay?
What's porcelain on top?
I don't know what you call it. It's made of ceramics or something. You know, the part or the countertop itself. Right, is that can't be koshered. Because again, I told you that's anything that's made of like china.
Next to the stovetop.
Right, between each burner or whatever, you know what I mean? Here's your square, and you have four burners on it, let's say. It doesn't have to be four, but I'm just saying. And the parts that separate the two, that's called porcelain. A lot of chametz falls on that. It really needs leibud, but we don't do leibud on porcelain. Or on enamel or this.
Ours is metal that's been painted like a glossy paint on top of this metal.
Oh, I see. Okay, so that's something different. Oh, yeah. I don't know how you would, but again, you're going to ruin it if you kosher it. I think so. Since it needs leibud, because again, it's direct contact with the chametz, I would say to cover it with heavy duty foil. That's your best.
That's your cover the whole thing.
So again, as I say, it's a bit of an undertaking. Okay, now sinks are a lot easier. Okay, now remember I told you that besides Hagolah, where there's a fire underneath the pot and boiling the water, there's another kind of kashering, which is called Kli Rishon. And here's where we need Kli Rishon. Sinks and Shayish. Okay, let me explain what I mean. How do you kasher sinks for Pesach? So what you do is you clean them out, wait 24 hours, and then you take boiling hot water and you pour it over the sink. Okay, every part of the sink should be covered, and try to do it immediately after it boils.
Sure.
So that's called Iri Kli Rishon, and then the sink is kosher for Pesach.
If it's metal.
Correct. That's a stainless steel sink. An enamel sink is much more complicated. Yeah. Then you have to use an insert.
But in the
case of a metal sink, you've already kashered the sink, but now you have to kasher the faucet. The faucet is also made of metal,
and
there, once again, you do Iri Kli Rishon. Now, in the middle of the sink, there's a drainage thing. If you could change that for Pesach, I'd be a happy camper, because a lot of chametz goes in there and it gets trapped, and it's not an easy thing. Now also, you have sometimes these faucets on a sink that have like a coil to it, almost like a whole tube. That becomes also a little bit more complicated. A lot of chametz gets caught in there. In theory, you could do hagola on that, and in this case, hagola would mean pouring hot water. But again, if you can get a replacement for Pesach for that faucet, you know, that has this whole steel coil. I don't know if you've seen it. It like moves with you. You know, it's very helpful in many ways. Yeah, but for Pesach, it's not so helpful.
Right, right.
So that's the kind of thing. So again, if we talk about countertops that are made of glass. So in the case of a stovetop, you know, if there's glass over the fire, you know what I'm saying, then we will kasha that. But in general, countertops that are made of glass, we don't really kasha, because we're always afraid it's going to get damaged by the hot, you know, by the boiling hot water.
So
now I have here something. This is from the Chicago kosher organization, and they write that the procedure for kashering a countertop is to clean it thoroughly, not use it for 24 hours, and then carefully pour boiling water on all the surfaces.
What type of countertop are they talking about?
I think that what they're talking about is what we call shayish. How do you call shayish in English?
Ceramica, that's not...
No, marble, I think it's called.
Granite.
Granite or marble.
Yeah.
Okay, now there are machnirim who have a minug, and that's my minug, is that even after we kasha the countertops, the marble countertops, we still cover them with, whether it's hard plastic, or whether it's with wood,
aluminum foil that really,
or the industrial thick aluminum foil. Those are beautiful, wonderful opportunities and alternatives to cover the countertops. Okay, then that's what I wanted to say about countertops. Okay, so we spoke about ovens, and we spoke about stovetops, we spoke about countertops, glass countertops. Again, for Sfaradim, glass countertops are not a problem, because the Sfaradim in general don't think that glass requires hechsher. They're not porous, and nothing goes in, and there's no blia whatsoever. But for Ashkenazim, glass is a bit of a problem, and if it's, you know, if you can guarantee yourself that it won't in any way damage the kli, it's a very hard, like in the case of stove countertops that are glass, then there is a possibility of kashering. Okay, let's just see what else I wanted to discuss with you as far as kashering the kitchen. Let's just see. Okay, so we spoke about marble countertops, we spoke about sinks, and we spoke about stoves, ovens, self-cleaning ovens, non-self-cleaning ovens, baking pans.
Hey, here's a very, real quick, like,
yeah.
You know, they have, you know, all these benchers, you know, so, I mean, all these, you know, we use them during the year, I guess we have to have, you know.
Benchrels? From benchers?
Yeah.
Get rid of them. Don't get rid of them. I mean, pack them up. There's so many crumbs and so many spills. You don't want to put that on your table.
Right.
Now, as far as baking pans, okay? Baking pans, if they're made of metal, they can be kashered, but you need a real serious limud. So therefore, I would do away with baking pans for Pesach. Don't kasher them. You may ruin them. And anything that might get ruined is not subject to hechsher. However, with regard to an electric plata, which in Yiddish we call it a blef, but today they call it a plata, so that could be kashered. However, there are two types of electric platot. There's one that's made of metal, and there's one that's made of enamel. Enamel might have the same status as earthenware and porcelain and things of the sort, which cannot be kashered because they're very porous, and you can't get the blia out. That's klicheres and yotzim v'dei dof yol yol. But if it's metal, then that's not a problem. You clean it very well. Turn on the electricity to the highest number, and afterwards cover it with aluminum foil. That's the way we do it as far as a plata. Most people today will buy a separate plata for Pesach. It's 250 shekel. Yeah, it's not going to burn a hole in your pocket. Microwaves. Now that's interesting. Again, the rich people can afford to buy a new microwave for Pesach, but for us regular guys, we'll call them, then you can kasher a microwave. The only part of the kashering process that's very iffy is the glass itself that keeps, where you put so the glass itself, which definitely needs kashering because all the chametz goes onto the glass and it's very hot. That's problematic. If you can get another glass to replace that, that would be the best.
Pesach Nikachina, just put a dish of Pesach Nikachina there.
I mean, so you don't use it. So you said take the glass out for Pesach.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Out and then you're putting in a Pesach dish.
Fine, that's fine. That's
the
great.
Is, well, that Pesach dish won't suddenly become chumetz dick because it is placed on top of you're using that in place of.
Oh, wait a minute. Did you remove the glass, or you're leaving it there and just covering?
No.
It?
We're taking the glass out.
So
now we're putting in the. But
so what might be? What were you asking?
What did we do to make the microwave oven Pesadik?
Oh, well, that we didn't get to yet. I was just talking first about the glass because that's the real issue.
Yeah.
And again, if you cannot replace the glass, then we're going to have to rely on those who. Like the Sfaradim, those Ashkenazim that say that you could kasher the glass,
but there's, you have the inside.
It's a problem.
You have the whole.
Okay, that's what we're up to. That's what we're up to now.
Okay.
So, let's assume that we replace the glass.
Okay. Sure.
How do you kasher the microwave?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So first of all, don't use it for 24 hours. Second of all, make sure it's absolutely clean. And third of all. Get yourself a bowl and fill it up with water and turn on the microwave.
Mm-hmm.
Let it cook as long as it takes until the steam starts filling up the microwave. At that point, it's kashered. It probably will take close to an hour. I don't know, maybe I'm exaggerating, but it'll take 20 minutes probably. Try it. It's worth a try.
I don't think we've ever used our microwave.
Okay, we use that microwave every Pesach.
Yeah, yeah.
We make what's called matzah pizza. That's our mainstay in the microwave. It's excellent. You take a matzah, you put cheese on it, you put ketchup on it, throw in a little garlic and so forth and so on. It's wonderful. It's a big hit now. I have. So a microwave is very critical. So this is the way we're going to kasher our microwave for Pesach.
Okay.
Now, in the case of a microwave, since you're using water, some would prefer that you add some sort of a cleaning fluid, into the water to make it what's called a tam pogum. Okay, then so you use some sort of cleaning agent or something that doesn't have a good taste to it, obviously.
Vinegar. The vinegar basically.
I don't know. Vinegar might be chametz. Yeah,
chometz.
There are different types of vinegar, but some types of wine vinegar is not chametz, but some vinegars is made actually from grains.
right.
Okay, tables should be cleaned very, very well. If you're eating directly from the table, which I would not recommend, but if you're doing so, then you have to pour boiling water over the table. From a kli rishon, meaning you're going to heat up your kettle, and then you're going to pour from the kettle onto the table. Again, that's all assuming that the table will not get ruined.
Just use a tablecloth and cover
by boiling water. Yeah, if you cover it with a tablecloth, nylon, plastic, whatever kind of tablecloth, then you're okay.
Uh-huh.
The refrigerator should be cleaned very, very well. There are many places where it's hard to, the crumbs of chametz get, and it's very hard to get them out. Again, we're going to rely on that head that I mentioned before about pouring a cleaning agent, some sort of liquid fluid, over the chametz, and then it's not roi l'achilas kelev, it's not fit for even a consumption by a dog. Now, frying pans are quite difficult. The Sfaradim, once again, have a kula that you can take a frying pan and put it into hot water and do hagala on it, because they hold that nobody fries things directly onto the pan. They always put oil or some sort of liquid substance. However, the Ashkenazim require libun, and the Ashkenazim are going to assume that there are cases where you fry something directly onto the pan without any oil. It could happen. So in order to avoid that, we want to do libun, which means you're going to have to heat up the frying pan to the point when you take a straw and you put it to the thing, it's going to scorch. Covers, obviously, have to be cleaned very well. And again, if you see that you're having trouble cleaning the covers, then spray something that has a very bad taste to it, some cleaning agent. Dishwashers. Okay, I'm not giving the talk about dishwashers. That's for a different discussion. If it's relevant, we can talk about it. Okay, now blenders and mixers are sometimes used with spicy foods, or sometimes even with hot foods. So therefore, they need hagola. Again, it's which part of the blender needs hagola? It's only the part that comes in contact with the food. You know, you have these inserts and the yes. and the part
blades. That,
the blades and so forth. That needs hagola. Now, silver cups, you know, like Kiddush cups and so forth, all you need is what's called kli rishon. That means just pour hot water over them, make sure the hot water spills over, and that's fine. We mentioned before about plastic baby bottles, that it's preferable to change them. If you have an electric kettle or an urn, it's complicated because you have to do hagola, and you got to fill it up with water until the point that the water actually spills over. And it could, I don't know, I'm not sure how it might affect the electric element, you know, and so forth. But again, earthenware vessels, which includes china, clay, ceramic, and porcelain, all those cannot be kashered.
Right.
And you can't use libun because it'll break. And I'm not sure about, glazed china, because glazed china, I think, has different status. Okay, toothbrushes and bottle brushes should not be kosher. Just buy a new set and don't mess around with it. Okay. Well, let me just see if I left anything.
The question always is, I keep forgetting. Before Pesach, you can prepare food for Pesach. It's bottle b'shishi. But then as soon as it's Pesach...
Then it's also b'mashu, right.
Yeah, kosher. So, you're using Pesach dishes and all this, and you're preparing, but you're doing it on a surface that not has it been kosh? I mean, have we done all of this stuff before we start cooking, or is it allowed to do it on these surfaces that we have not followed all of these procedures?
No, you can only cook for Pesach after these procedures
have all been done.
Right.
So you need to be Pesach, you know, several days before.
In order to cook
for Pesach, yes. It has to be done several days before. Okay. So let's see, that's clarity for clarity.
Now I wanted to ask if there are any things that you could buy that don't need a hechsher. Okay, so first of all, bottled water, that's okay. Doesn't need certification.
I also heard that, coffee and tea.
Okay, we'll get to coffee. Second, eggs, raw eggs, don't need a hechsher.
Uh-huh.
Fruits and vegetables, even if they're coated, do not need a hechsher. However, there's one exception to this rule, and that's what we call dried fruits. Dried fruits are coated with substances that might be kidneys. Now, we didn't discuss kidneys yet, so I just want to say a few words about coffee, and then we'll go for a minute to talk about kidneys, okay? And quinoa and those issues. As far as coffee is concerned, there are different methods of removing caffeine from coffee beans. And the common denominator of all of them is the beans come in contact with hot liquid that draws the caffeine out of the bean. So let's talk about decaffeinated coffee.
Oh,
okay, so there's a liquid substance, and it's hot, and that draws the caffeine out of the beans. Now, what is this liquid substance that's used for decaffeinization? It could be water. It could be a chemical, and that should be okay, but it might be a combination of the two. And the problem is that since this chemical comes in contact, direct contact with the coffee beans in a hot situation, we have to make sure that these chemicals are not made of any chametz. Now, there's something called ethyl acetate, and some of this stuff might have a problem, either of chametz or of kidneys. So you really should buy decaffeinated coffee with a hechsher on it. Okay? Again, the issue might be ethyl acetate that's derived from chametz. Sometimes even the water that they use to decaffeinate the beans is purified on carbon, and they may use hot ethyl alcohol, which is derived from chametz. I mean, basically, the bottom line is that decaffeinated coffee needs a hechsher, it needs a certification for kashrus.
Is Osharad a good place to get everything that you don't have to worry
about? I think so, as far as I know. But again,
but you have to worry about
kidneys. Exactly. So you have to make sure that it has a familiar hechsher for Ashkenazim, you know, whether it's Chasam Sofer, whether it's Rav Rubin, whatever the hechsher is, Badat, and therefore you know it doesn't have kidneys in it.
Right.
Many products will say we ochle kidneys bilvad. It's only for Sfarad.
Right.
Okay.
Or it should say lelo chashash shal
kidneys. Right. Now, gluten-free foods don't have chametz in it, but a lot of people make mistakes and they think that gluten-free foods, if you're a never celiac or you just don't want to take gluten, that's by definition is kosher for Pesach. That's a mistake for two reasons. Number one, because oats might be gluten-free, yet if you mix it with water, it's chametz gomer.
Really?
And you chayv karis. And number two, very often you have rice and corn and beans and all that stuff that are gluten-free, but they cannot be eaten by Ashkenazim because they are kidneys. And that's where we jump into the medical problems with pills. A lot of pills are what we call coated pills. They're coated with a glaze, a wax, shellac, whatever they use to make it easier to swallow. Some of those coatings have sucrose in it. Sucrose sometimes is made with ingredients that pose a Pesach problem. And therefore the best thing is to get pills without a coating. If you're stuck with the situation of a pill with a coating, there may be heterim and different ways you can take the pill. It depends on how badly you need the pill. One of the heterim, which again you have to know if it applies, depending on what the sucrose percentage is in the thing, is to chew a pill instead of swallowing. You know, so if you have a pill that's generally swallowed, let's say you take it with water, and you go ahead and chew it, that might be a heter. Otherwise, you can wrap it up in a little bit of a tissue and swallow it down. Just make sure the tissue is pasted. And then we have something called Advil that's very common. And if you look at some of the ingredients in Advil, very often they have what's called a pharmaceutical glaze on them, which is made of sucrose. And once again, this could be theoretically a problem of kidneys. Now, I don't know if any of you would ever have a chance to, on Pesach, on Chol Hamoed, to take a colonoscopy. It's a horrible process of preparing for it. But basically, all the ingredients that you have to take down in order to prepare yourself for the colonoscopy are okay for Pesach.
Oh.
So, you know, next time you have to schedule a colonoscopy for Chol Hamoed Pesach, you're pretty much okay. Now, I wanted to say a few words about kidneys. Let me just see if I can find the right page here that I prepared. Oh, yeah. Okay, for Ashkenazim, there's a minhag that goes back to the Middle Ages. It goes back to the time of the Maharil, that's in the 1200s, of not eating kidneys. And the Mishnah Berurah offers three explanations for this minhag. Number one, these are harvested and processed in the same manner as chametz. So they look a little bit like chametz. Like, for example, if you talk about processing potatoes and making it into potato starch, that should be kidneys. We're going to have to explain why potatoes are not kidneys. Number two, if it is baked in a way that's similar to the way we bake chametz, also we can confuse with chametz, and if we don't want to eat kidneys. And number three, sometimes the grains that we call kidneys are mixed together with chametz thicker grains. And I mentioned these three issues because I want to talk to you about I call it quinoa. You have a different pronunciation?
Quinoa.
Quinoa. Okay, the issue of quinoa is still an ongoing issue today.
Really?
And I'll tell you what it is. On the one hand, quinoa has at least one of the reasons for, because very often
it's prepared in the same way.
It's prepared in the same way, and it very often is mixed together with other grains. And the only quinoa that we're even talking about for Pesach, it has to have a hechsher on it.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But even though logically it would be kidneyous, however, it was discovered, or shall we say, it was introduced to the northern hemisphere from the southern hemisphere very recently, and therefore it was never included in the original gzera of kidneyous.
Yep.
And that's what Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a different shuv, he's not talking about quinoa. He says that the reason why we're allowed to eat potatoes and we're allowed to make potato starch, and there's so many similarities to kidneys, is because the Maharil was back in the the 1200s and the 1400s, and potatoes didn't hit Europe until the 16th century.
Oh, wow.
So it's a new vegetable, and it wasn't included in the original Minna.
So
in fact,
Rav
Moshe Feinstein, by the way, wants to be makel as far as peanuts are concerned, and that's an issue. Peanut oil and cotton oil are okay in America, but here in Israel they became more machmir
about that.
And the Israelis don't use cotton oil. So if you want to get cotton oil, you've got to import it from Chutz La'aretz if you want it to be Pesach. And again, as far as quinoa is concerned, even though we're going to say that it's not kidneyos, but nevertheless, you have to have a strict hechsher on it because it's packaged very often together in the same plants that package wheat, barley, and so forth, other grains that are chametz, and they might get mixed up into the quinoa. So there's got to be a mashgiach there. But once you have, and again, I'm not sure how easy it is to get it here in Israel, I think you can, but for sure, I remember in America we could get a hechsher on quinoa, no problem. Now, as far as oil that's made from kidneys is concerned, the Ramah was machmir on this, and he said we don't use oils on Pesach that are extracts from kidneys. And therefore, we don't use corn oil, because corn is kidneys. We don't use soybean oil, which we call vegetable oil. And peanut oil, according to the Ramah, strictly should be usur. Again, there are those who are making on peanut oil for other reasons. Now, if you have oil that comes from olives, or palm, or coconut, or walnuts, all that is accessible. Acceptable, sorry. Why? Because the fruits from which these are extracted are not kidneys.
Right, it's from trees, I think.
Okay, great. So that we have canola oil, which became approved for use in the United States in 1985, and therefore there were those who want to suggest it's new and it's not included in the Gzeira as we saw in the Igros Moshe. No, that's a mistake, because canola oil is not new. Canola oil is actually rapeseed oil. The fancy name for it is colza oil, and that's been used for centuries in Europe, and it is kidneys. So forget about canola oil. You can talk about olive oil, you can talk about palm oil, which is not too healthy. You can talk about walnut oil and coconut oil. None of this is healthy, by the way. You can talk, that's on a different level, that's for health issues.
Yeah.
And you can talk perhaps about cottonseed oil, but not rapeseed oil,
right,
which is called canola oil. That's as far as kidneys is concerned. Okay. Okay. Now, I want to say a few words about tefillas kelim, which means taking kelim to the mikvah. This is not specifically for Pesach. It's for the whole year round. But it seems to become very relevant Pesach time, because we buy new pots and other utensils specifically for Pesach. If these items, these kelim, are made of either metal, aluminum, iron, pewter, stainless steel, tin, and even glass, you're not allowed to use them without tefillas kelim. And tefillas kelim means you have to take them to a mikveh, and you have to immerse them in a mikveh. The entire kli has to be immersed in the mikveh. You have to clean off any dirt or any attachments, what do they call them, those madbekot, what are they called?
No,
in other words, when you buy a new kli, very often there are, you know, that sticky stuff on it, you know what I'm talking about? You know, they tell you what the price is, all sorts of types of sticky tags, you know, stuff. Yeah, you want to take those off. And if it is produced or manufactured by non-Jews, so anything that's purchased here that was produced and manufactured elsewhere requires tefillas kelim.
Okay? By Jews?
Now, if you buy a kli that from a Jew, in other words, it was manufactured by a Jew, that doesn't need tefillas kelim.
Really?
Right.
So there are, I guess.
So if it was created by a Jewish firm here in Israel, and then you can buy pots that are made. A lot of people buy pots from America and so forth and so on. You can get them here. But if you're buying locally produced pots here in Israel, you don't need tefillah.
Huh.
Okay, now, scissors, a pair of scissors does not need tefillah, but kitchen scissors, which were specifically manufactured and purchased in order to cut meat and the like, you know, chicken, those need tefillah. Now again, this is not relevant to Pesach, but you should know that toaster ovens are very problematic because they're made of steel, and they need tefillah. But how are you going to be tovel an oven? I mean, the whole thing is going to get ruined.
Yeah, the electric.
So you have to find all sorts of kulos and heterim about how to circumvent the law of tefillah with regard to toasters. Rabbi Shmuel Feinstein, by the way, is famous for saying that a toaster doesn't need tefillah. Why? Because only a kli that is either used for eating or that prepares food that's not edible, right? So let's say, for example, I have a pot that I cook raw meat in it, and I can't eat the raw meat until I cook it. That pot needs tefillah. But he claims that in the case of a toaster, what you put in the toaster is bread, and that bread is edible even without toasting it. And therefore, it's not a kli bishul. So I'm not sure whether Lamaisa we rely on Reb Moshe. There are other ways of solving the problem of toasters.
I consider Reb Moshe such a makel guy.
Yeah, well, it depends what the issue is. You know, he was a big makel, actually. He got a lot of flack for that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because he was an original thinker.
Yeah.
He was a real lamdan. Yeah. And he paskin based on his understanding.
Yeah. The smarter you are,
you know. For example, artificial insemination got him real trouble.
Oh, yeah.
But all artificial insemination today goes back to Reb Moshe. He was the matir. He was the lenient one. Okay. And there are many, many other things. Okay, then. So that's as far as tefillas kelim is concerned. Now, peelers did not need tefillah.
Right.
But some people will be tovel a grater or a peeler. Just in case, meaning just in case it's used for food that cannot be eaten without being, you know, peeled and so forth and so on. So in such a case, I would leave out the bracha. You know, I'd be tovel. But glass, for example, needs tefillah with a bracha because that's a rabbinic institution. But like any other mitzvah d'rabbanan, it requires a bracha. Okay, so again, we said before that the kli, once it's submerged in the mikvah, has to be free of any kind of stickers or labels and removed before tefillah, because that would block the direct connection contact between the water and the kli. And if we're being tovel many dishes at the same time, it's also the tzivano al tevilas kelim. Okay. Now, young people have braces on their teeth. Okay, they'll be told by the orthodontists that they should clean them before Pesach. The best thing is to use what's called a water flosser. I think it's called water pick. I think you mentioned it before. And that's the best place in general the whole year round to clean braces, but certainly for Pesach. If you don't have that, then you might have to find another effective tool for removing any residue chametz that might be in the braces. And there's something called praxa brush, which is a narrow bristled kind of a brush, and it fits in between the different wires and the brackets, and that's what you have. Barbecues, grills, very hard to kasha them for Pesach. They really need libun gomor, which is not something that we can do. Imagine, you know, burning it until it goes up with a red fire. So therefore, what we do is, if we want to use that grill, we have to
new grates.
Buy new grates, exactly. Purchase separate grates for Pesach, and then the grill could be kashered by simply covering over the grill, and you light the grill with coals or gas, whatever you use, close the cover, allow it to burn to its highest setting for about an hour. And then, you know, you put in the, you know, your new grates, for the Pesach grapes, the brand new ones, and then you're set to have your naftaf, your grills, over Pesach. People who suffer from diabetes, unfortunately, have a rough time with the Seder because we eat a lot of matzah, which is full of carbs, and we have plenty of wine, which is full of carbs, sugars and carbs, and that's not good for a diabetes person. Anyone who has that issue should really refer to a certain website by Rabbi Meisel. It's called Friends with Diabetes, if you're familiar with that site. If not, I can photocopy it for you later on. There's something called glucose tablets, dextrose, ascorbic acid, citric acid flavors. All this might have chametz in it. And unless there's some serious reason for someone who suffers from diabetes or something of the like, and then we'll permit it. Otherwise, you really need a doctor to tell you how to substitute, you know, something else for these glucose tablets in order not to involve any sort of an issue. In Chutz La'aretz this year, Yontif goes into Shabbos. In other words, here in Eretz, so we finish Yontif on Friday.
So to be pessimistic, because we can't change.
Right. We finish on Friday. So in Chutz La'aretz, if they want to cook on Yontif for Shabbos, they need what's called an Erev Tavshilin. And we can discuss that at great length.
Well, we don't need an Erev Tavshilin because it's just one day Yontif.
We don't need an Erev Tavshilin.
Yeah, look at that.
Okay, if anyone's interested, I have some very interesting pictures of the Seder plate and how it's meant to be structured. A whole discussion about matzah, different discussions about whiskey and vinegars and different kinds of substances like vitamins and enzymes that we take for our health. What's their status on Pesach? Like that, maybe we'll talk about next week. In the meantime, thank you.
Okay.
And whatever we were able to blitzkrieg in that hour, that's what we did. Yeah. And if you know, this is the one holiday where you might want to convert to Sephardiism and become a Sephardi, because in kashering your kitchen, it's a lot more cool.
You need to just have Haddalah.
Yeah, right. You're going to need tefillah in a mikvah, and once you make that conversion, there's no turning back. You know, you're never an Ashkenazi again. You know, so. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.